Of the 63 clauses King John sealed at Runnymede in 1215, only three survive on the UK statute book today. Three. That is a striking number, Alina, because it tells you something important right away. Magna Carta's power was never really about its specific legal text. It was about the idea it planted, that a king could be bound by law. The barons who forced John's hand were not idealists. They were landowners protecting their property and their income. But the deal they struck created a template that would reshape British governance for the next 8 centuries. Think of a medieval king as Mancur Olsen's stationary bandit made flesh. A roving bandit simply plunders and moves on. A stationary bandit, a king who stays, has an incentive to stop plundering quite so aggressively, because he needs his subjects productive enough to tax again next year. The key idea is this: institutional constraints on royal power were not charity from above. They were rational bargains. When Edward I summoned the Model Parliament in 1295, he was not feeling generous toward commoners. He needed money for wars in France and Wales. His solution was to invite representatives of the shires and towns to Westminster. The principle he accepted was direct: what touches all should be approved by all. Consent for taxation was now a formal requirement. That is a seismic shift. Power had moved, even slightly, from the person of the king to a process. Now, these early constraints were fragile. They could be ignored, they often were. But each time a monarch violated them and then needed money again, the bargaining resumed. The tension built across centuries until it exploded in the 1640s. Charles I ruled for 11 years without calling Parliament at all. When he finally needed funds, Parliament refused to cooperate. Civil war followed, and then came something genuinely unprecedented: a king on trial. During his trial, in 1649, Charles I refused to enter a plea. His argument was not cowardice, it was constitutional. His power came from God, he said. No earthly court had the jurisdiction to judge him. It was a coherent position by the logic of divine right monarchy. The court disagreed, they executed him anyway. For the first time in English history, the institution had formally overruled the person wearing the crown. The economic consequences of that shift were enormous, and economists Douglas North and Barry Weingast documented them precisely. After the institutional constraints on the monarchy were locked in during the 17th century, the UK government could borrow money at significantly lower interest rates than absolute monarchs elsewhere in Europe. For example, a French king who could repudiate his debts at will was a bad credit risk. An English government constrained by Parliament, where creditors themselves often sat, was a far safer bet. The takeaway is almost counterintuitive. Surrendering some power made the British state more powerful, not less. It could fund armies, navies, and eventually an empire, because lenders trusted it to repay. Institutional credibility became a strategic weapon. The foundation of UK democracy, Alina, was not a single revolution or a heroic moment of popular will. It was a long sequence of elite bargains: barons protecting their estates, merchants protecting their trade, parliamentarians protecting their loans. Each bargain chipped away at the idea that law lived inside the king's will. Each one moved law a little further into the institution of the state itself. That is the key takeaway from everything covered here. The rule of law in Britain was not declared, it was negotiated, clause by clause, crisis by crisis, over centuries. And that slow, contested, often violent process is precisely why it proved durable. Institutions built through genuine conflict tend to stick. The ones handed down from above tend not to. Britain's constitutional story is, at its core, a story about who controls the rules and how that control was gradually, irreversibly, pried away from one man and given to a system.